Hello and welcome to this Open Corporates podcast. In early October 2021, the Pandora Papers, one of the largest leaks of offshore data, made headlines around the world. Since then, we have seen a stream of investigative stories into the leaked data. Much ink has been spilt on the actions of those named in these stories, including politicians, celebrities, and other high-profile figures. In this episode, we'll want to take a step back and focus on the longer-term impact of the Pandora Papers. We'll discuss why the Pandora Papers should be a wake-up call, driving forward changes to promote corporate transparency. And as part of this, we'll cover what compliance professionals should be doing differently in response to the revelations brought to light in the Pandora Papers, and the state of key legislative reforms on the table that could drive greater corporate transparency. So for today's conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by Rebecca Lee, Chief Impact Officer at Open Corporates and the former lead of PwC's Forensic Analytics Unit in London.
Hi, Shanti.
And Letty Hoffman, Market Specialist for Due Diligence at Dow Jones Risk and Compliance.
Hello.
So, Rebecca, for those who may have missed it, can you give our listeners an overview of the Pandora Papers investigation and why it's been so significant?
So yes, we've seen a number of data leaks over the past couple of years, and the Pandora Papers at 11.9 million files, which is nearly 3 terabytes of data, is huge. And that's bigger than the Panama Papers, which looked at Mossack Fonseca, and the Paradise Papers, which looked at kind of offshore investments from a legal firm and corporate service providers. And the investigation is based on a leak of confidential records. So 14 offshore service providers that have given professional services to wealthy individuals, corporations, those that are seeking to incorporate things like shell companies, trusts, foundations in low or generally no tax jurisdictions. And it was the largest journalism collaboration to date. So we saw more than 600 journalists from 150 media outlets over 117 countries looking at this, which is a huge organizational feat. And as you said, Shanti, there's been lots of individual stories out of this. So individuals included more than 100 billionaires, 29,000 offshore accounts, 30 current and former leaders, 336 politicians from 90 countries, but also political donors, celebrities, criminals, and business leaders. And the types of stories are kind of wealth around offshore accounts or properties and investments bought by via offshore companies. And the implication is that there's kind of either potential tax avoidance and hiding of assets, although it's really important to note that pretty much all of the stories noted that those individuals hadn't been accused of breaking any laws. So, yeah, I mean, we've also seen follow-ups such as impeachment vote in Chile and lawmakers across the world for investigations and other financial regulators examining what has come out of the Pandora Papers. So it's really seen as a significant, particularly because it's in the public eye. Those data stories around those individuals have made financial crime and the use of offshore jurisdictions pertinent to individuals on the street. People outside of the anti-financial crime community were talking about those stories.
So for those working in risk and compliance, is any of this really new? And who wants to go first?
Shanti, I think maybe I can take this one. So the short answer, I think, is no, there's nothing really groundbreaking or new here. And I'm excited also to hear what Rebecca has to say there. But there's certain things that Pandora highlights, certain challenges in the research, certain challenges that compliance professionals are facing and have been facing for a while. So the complexities faced by the ICIJ when processing and analyzing this incredible amount of data, which we've just heard about, reflects the general challenges of compliance and due diligence research, because it requires a smart and multi-jurisdictional, multilingual data analysis and teams of experts with varying backgrounds in order to sift through the types of data, the type of information, and make something out of it. So I think you know, overall, it's not really something new, but it does highlight some things that we were familiar with, some jurisdictions that have always raised maybe more alarms than others. Or as Rebecca also just said, we see some changes happening, as in Chile with the impeachment vote. So there's a certain knock-on effect that I think is currently felt globally.
I would say, again, similar to what Leti said, it's more of the same, really. It's the latest in a long line of investigations that looked at the offshore financial systems. I mean, LuxLeaks is another one that I didn't mention before. And abuse of corporate vehicles, unfortunately, is nothing new at all. So that can be to facilitate kind of criminal behaviour, hide assets, or simply to conceal who controls and benefits from companies. And so it will mean that, similar to kind of the previous leak, those responsible in the risk and compliance areas will need to look at their client list. They'll need to understand how it may impact any risks associated with those individuals, whether that's regulatory or actually it's political or public pressure. We have seen some legislative change in terms of Panama. There was a lot of pressure for UBO registers, but we have seen that some of that legislation has stalled, and certainly some of the implementation has. I think one thing that really was different for me from this leak was the fact that it did include some ultimate beneficial ownership information that was submitted to the BVI UBO register. So just as a background, the BVI does have a UBO register, but it isn't public. Now, late last year, they did commit, just like the other British Overseas territories, to making those registers public by 2023. But that information is not available at present. And the leak did include kind of UBO submitted filings to the BVI, which had a really interesting set of information attached to them.
Thanks, Leti. Thanks, Rebecca. What concrete steps would it take to promote the kind of corporate transparency to deter abuse of corporate vehicles, as was seen in the Pandora Papers?
I think one main message that I've been taking from the Pandora Papers is something, again, we are not speaking about anything new here, but we are sort of having held a mirror to our own faces. I think there's been a new development in terms of putting a nail into this illusion that this global money laundering and tax evasion or any sort of financial crime, that that's happening far away, that that's in some far off exotic island jurisdiction in the Caribbean or the Pacific. I think, of course, those kind of jurisdictions play an important role, but a good part of the transactions are happening right here. They're happening in New York, in London, in Western metropolises. There is often like an involvement of, for example, local real estate. And I think something that the Pandora Papers have done, though, is hold the mirror in front of our faces and kind of in terms of showing what we need to do. Legislative reform is not something that we can just demand of these far-off jurisdictions. This is a global problem. This is an intertwined problem. Offshore in itself implies that the power brokers may not sit in that jurisdiction. So I think it really showed the public and the consumers of this data that we do need to take global legislative steps. And I'm sure Rebecca would agree with me there as well. And there's a number of legislative initiatives globally that are going on, which maybe we can speak about a little bit later. But basically, the thing that needs to happen is, yeah, a global reform, acknowledging our own role, acknowledging kind of the power brokers that sit behind and the root causes of why there's so much success in these systems.
I agree. I mean, it's not just been the offshore jurisdictions or even British overseas territories which are at fault here. A lot of the stories came out in terms of the UK and the big European US jurisdictions. I mean, I think what change needs to be made, I'd absolutely agree, it's globally. We operate as individuals. We contract constantly with not just companies in our local jurisdictions, in the UK, for example, but across the world, just in our day-to-day use of our phones and the applications. So global is really important. And obviously, there's also got to be legislation to close loopholes in our kind of financial systems, for example, around tax and property regulation, etc. But it's all right doing those things, but really at the most basic layer, we still don't understand globally what companies there are and the individuals, whether they are the directors and officers or the beneficiaries of those companies. And so without knowing what companies are out there, what relationships are out there, we can't link to the potential abuse of corporate vehicles. We need to have that kind of trusted business environment, and trust is driven from transparency and accountability. And it's a shame that at the moment it takes leaks to uncover potentially moral, if not illegal, behaviour and practices. We've certainly understood more about the global financial systems in the world as a result of leaks, as opposed to regulation. And so we kind of need that global view of really the basics around what corporate vehicles are out there. And at the moment, we don't have that kind of globally. And that really stops you being able to hold companies to account, hold individuals to account, and ensure that they're operating within the realms of what they should be, what they're regulated to be, whether politicians have got outside interest, for example. You can't hold them up to account if that information about what they are involved with is hidden.
In addition to that, I think you can't hold them account to a standard, but then almost, or sadly, I guess, the problem is, you know, what is the standard if now, again, and kind of maybe sounding like a broken record, but if those countries that are spearheading the global anti-corruptive drive, spearheading those legislations, are seen as having robust legislative frameworks working towards this direction, are in fact in the center of these kind of leaks, where are we actually going? What is then the standard? You know, it's hard to hold the baton of morality in this realm when we're really looking at ourselves here as well. So, you know, we don't have that information, but with what legitimacy can we, and I use this term loosely, I guess, ask for it? Because we are really not at a point, I think, where that standard has been defined. I think it's almost a sort of theoretic or morality debate so often when it comes down to it, because when you use it, look at offshore vehicles, when you, for example, and there is a lot of academic discourse as to why it's great. So as long as we are not having reached any sort of actual consensus in a certain way, and we keep implementing lax legislation as a result of lip service, how are we going to get to that transparency that you rightly pointed out would be needed in order to effectively address these loopholes?
So great points there. Moving on in more, let's say, concrete and practical directions, are there any measures on the table at present that could promote greater corporate transparency?
So I suppose one of the things that's been directly linked with Pandora is the announcement of the US Enablers Act. So this has been worked on for at least 2 years, but its introduction now, which was potentially early, is interesting because it was a bipartisan measure requiring that enablers to perform background checks on money flowing into their businesses, but to also report those suspicions around funds and other suspicious activities. And of course, it is the enablers that have been really highlighted as part of this leak. So certainly a real good piece of legislation potentially in the US. I think in terms of the UK, the really relevant bit of legislation is the Register of Beneficial Owners of Overseas Entities, which own land in the UK. Now, again, that was meant to be by 2021, but we've really seen that stalled. We haven't seen that released yet. And that will be maintained by Companies House. So they're the kind of the two real pieces of legislation that have been talked about directly as a result of being influenced by Pandora in terms of their timing. We've obviously seen the US Transparency Act, but certainly that doesn't really promote greater corporate transparency. It mandates that beneficial ownership information will be collected by FinCEN, but it's not going to be public information. So although it supports government agencies and banks, it doesn't really support the ability for the public and journalists, for example, to scrutinise. The other key ones are probably the Open Data and PSI Directive. So that's European legislation, which should have been implemented by July this year. And it's still in the implementation process, awaiting the public consultation. So it's quite a way held back. It's been delayed parts of COVID, but also really is a lack of political will. There's been a lot of pushback from member states and no one really pushing forward on it. And just for those that don't know, it requires that company data and ownership information to be made available freely and in machine readable formats. But we think that's going to really come through as a recommendation that is, it's called the low recommendation. And that means that there'll be terms and conditions added. Potentially, there won't even be information about the beneficial owners themselves. So again, real concern about that legislation and a real stalling, which we hope Pandora will kick a little bit. Companies House reform, again, all of these things seem to be just stuck on the legislative calendar. The fact that they're looking to challenge and not just record what people have told them is excellent, really great. So there's verification and ability to kind of investigate. But when that's going to be in process is anyone's guess. So again, there's the frustration in the community that hasn't been pushed forward. And then finally, the fact that through AMLDs, so 5 and 6, UBO registers were meant to be publicly available across Europe. It's been partially adopted by some European countries, but there have been 22 infringement procedures for failing or delaying to implement. It was expected. We should have that information. It should be publicly available, and it has just not actually been completed.
Thank you very much. That was an incredible summary. So I love that. I think, you know, what it boils down to is the glacial pace in which it's really been implemented is very frustrating. Looking sometimes at the draft document of these legislations versus texts that are submitted for approval or proceeding, you see that even where we started with some ambition, it often boils down to something that's actually paying more lip service to change than it is really honing in on any change. And that can be quite frustrating, you know, seeing the concerns also within Dow Jones, with our clients, UBO registries, you said it now, right? It's often that's vital data to look at, and a lack of access is continuing to hinder the kind of efforts made by compliance teams across the globe to really be able to address this kind of risk. So it's nice to see so many legislations on the agenda on the one hand. On the other hand, a lot of us are looking at it with a level of skepticism in terms of how fast, or is it as much as it seems, or is it just a pretty picture?
Yeah, I completely agree. No, it's really frustrating for those of us in the community who are really pushing for some of this legislation that has been tabled to be implemented, and to see it kind of just stuck and not moving forward.
Great points all around. So we often hear messages from parts of the anti-financial crime community that firms should simply do more due diligence in response to stories like the Pandora Papers. But is that really enough? Should compliance professionals do something different?
I think doing more is a very simplified way of looking at things. I think it's time to revisit what you do, you know, in terms of DD. I think it's time to look at the strategic approaches that you have in terms of risk appetite, but looking critically at your industry of where you're operating and risks associated with that. I also think, you know, we are moving from a set of data that's often been very highly structured to very well-organized unstructured data that now needs to be looked into. And that in itself will change processes. It will change the way in which due diligence is conducted. And I think just saying more is more in this case is actually not going to be the answer. A lot of firms are also facing difficulties in implementing risk-based programs and approaches to the extent that they want to. There's limited resources and ever-increasing regulatory landscape, kind of as the juxtaposition on that. Businesses are not, compliance is nobody's favorite cost, except for all of us who work in compliance. But I think, you know, a lot of compliance teams are facing an uphill battle also in terms of what the responsibilities are and what they want to do. So again, I think more it's about doing smarter DD. It's about having a strategic, a risk-based approach, being able to allocate resources in a considerate and thoughtful manner that is very much tailored to the environment a given team is operating in. You know, part of that is the exchange, an exchange like this between people to kind of consider, learn, and hear from different perspectives on how, what kind of levels and things we need to consider.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You've got a problem where you've got a lot that you're required to do with ever increasing pressure on resources, and yet not useful information being available. I mean, how do you do due diligence where you've got information being presented by companies, and those with nefarious purposes are going to not present you the truth, right? So how do you verify that when the information is self-reported and you can't check who the UBOs are based on what they've submitted to the authorities or who the directors and officers are? You need to be able to have that information available, and in a way that you're not, for the US, for example, looking at data from every individual state. All of this information is made available and you can test it. But you can't expect an industry such as enablers to go and do a ton of compliance about who they are that they're not expected to do, right? There's been no regulation that has required those risk and compliance teams to go and report concerns about source of funds. So you're not going to have risk and compliance teams doing something that they are not regulated to do. But I do think that we do need to move away from that tick box regulated driven approach and give the leeway that individuals have got the ability to go and look and deep dive if they feel that they need to kind of fulfill the purpose of what we're really trying to get to, which is trying to combat financial crime. And in sometimes the processes aren't designed to do that. They're literally designed to get through what you need to report to a regulator and cover yourselves from a regulation point of view. I suppose I should add, I've never met one person in the anti-financial crime community that doesn't want to fight financial crime and hasn't got in it to try and do the right thing here.
So true. It kind of goes back, right? It's the people working in it are not the ones that need the convincing.
Great points all around. So to round out today's discussion, are there any positives on the immediate horizon that we can leave our listeners with that could create greater corporate transparency?
I think from my point of view, there are jurisdictions that are moving to an open data mandate that haven't necessarily been mandated to. So Illinois in March, we've been campaigning with kind of other partners for a corporate transparency bill, which had an open data mandate around company registration information. And that's been delayed, again, going at a glacial speed. That piece of legislation will be effective on the 1st of January 2022. And we've seen other US states, such as Connecticut, move to an open data policy. So that information will be made available, not just in bulk to those who can pay for it, the data providers who aggregate it, but that will be made available to everyone to be able to query and investigate it.
Yeah, despite maybe the slightly dimmed outlook we had on this glacial legislative phase, you know, we are talking about it. It is in the news. And as we said at the very beginning of the recordings, there have been politicians, there have been celebrities. Pandora, a positive outcome, I think, is that it's made its way into kind of a public consciousness because of some sensationalism that is there. And I think every single piece of news coverage, every bit of attention can only help to get these legislative processes up to speed and get us where we want to be. You know, like if everybody cares, hopefully we can collectively make it happen a bit faster than maybe we'd hope for. So I think a bit of a broader note, but as long as we keep shining the light, I'm sure there's going to be really good developments. And I'm just happy to see, yeah, all the conversations and all the buzz. And I'm just, yeah, very happy to have been part of this conversation as well.
Excellent discussion, everyone. So that is all the time we have for today. Thank you to our guests, Rebecca Lee and Letty Hoffman, for sharing your perspectives on these critical issues. And thank you to everybody for listening to us. If you're interested in hearing more about the role transparent company data played in the Pandora Papers investigation, listen to our previous podcast episode where Rebecca speaks to two members of the ICIJ team who worked on the investigation. Simply navigate to the previous episode on your podcast player or on the Open Corporates blog. Bye for now.